welcome our listeners to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip, brought to you by Sim Training, the Dayton area's first indoor range and indoor firearms training center. I'm Jeff Pedro, in with Mark Avery. Sim Trainer is located down on Dryden Road at 2031 Dryden Road, right across from DP&L. You can reach us on the web at www.sim-trainer.com, or you can give us a call at 937-293-3914. If you'd like to call into the show today, I want to remind our listeners you can call us at 457-1290. That's 457-1290. If you have any issues you'd like to discuss, any matters you want to get resolved, any firearms-related matters that you would like to talk about. And I want to start today's show off with pretty much what Mark predicted and I anticipated was going to happen during this past week as a result of the fallout from the tragic incident that occurred in Tucson, Arizona, last weekend, whereby the anti-gunners right away rushed to the media to start purporting that that was an incident that further supports their claim that it's guns in society that cause all the evil that, that exists.
It didn't even take them 24 hours before they were up there dancing in the blood.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's just really disgusting.
Absolutely. And I know people, it brings up a lot of issues. There are a lot of issues that are loaded in into this. And I want to just start off by saying that we extend our sympathy and compassion to the family members of all those who have lost their lives and to those that were injured in that tragic incident. But as the father of Christina, the young girl that was killed in the Christina Green, I believe it was, as he said, life has to go on, and we have to learn from this incident, and we have to go on. And I think one of the ways that we can learn and move forward is to talk about the incidents of that day. And I just want to start off and just recap for those who may not be aware of it. The facts are pretty well established based on reports from the sheriff's office, the police department, that were reported in news conferences the past week. But essentially, an armed gunman emerged from the crowd and started shooting in a spontaneous situation
in
an open air,
point blank range.
Yeah, at point blank range. It was in an open air street corner gathering where the politicians are going out to reach their constituents, and he ended up hitting about 15 people, killing six and wounding several others. And now here's the important part that I want to mention. It was the spontaneous and heroic acts of three citizens, one a 74-year-old retired colonel from the military, another a male subject in his 30s, and then a female, I think she was 61 years old, who basically attacked this gunman once he stopped firing after anywhere from 12 to 15 seconds is what the estimate is. When he went to reload, they attacked him. The 74-year-old hit him over the head with a folding chair. The 31-year-old male jumped on his back, put his knee in the back of his neck, held him to the ground, and the 61-year-old picked up the gun and the magazine, and they subdued him until law enforcement arrived on the scene. Which, by the way, as I've mentioned so many times, is typically how these situations end when we have spontaneous acts of extreme violence by active shooters. It is, in fact, the heroic acts of people on the scene that bring them to a shorter resolution because law enforcement, I would venture to guess that the first 911 call had probably just been placed and may not have even been called by the time the shooter was actually subdued on the scene, because by the time you figure it takes somebody to realize something's going on, take cover like they probably did, or start to run and then grab their cell phone, open the cell phone and dial 911 if they can dial it right on the first try, and then the period of time it takes for that call to go through the switchboard or go through the network and get to the police dispatcher, I'm guessing, just based on the facts, that the situation was actually over by that time. So nonetheless, it certainly was over before law enforcement got there, and that's not a knock on law enforcement. That's just the reality of the circumstances the way they exist. Another thing I want to bring up that was brought up by the father of the young girl who was killed in this incident, he said that he said actually two things that are relevant here. He said it's one of the prices we pay in a free society where we're going to have spontaneous acts of extreme violence. And the other thing he said is he did not want this incident to be the catalyst for further restrictions on individual rights. And I thought that was pretty telling coming from an individual who had just lost his loving daughter. And he still had the sense about him to talk in those kinds of tones and to say the things he said. And and just to have the impact that he has on all of us in moving forward. No doubt it was a tragic incident. Well, not very long after that, within 24 hours, there was another individual, a Republican congressman in New York, who thought that he was going to get the media's attention and he was going to go ahead and he had a solution to the problem. He's going to pass a law, or he was going to introduce a law that will not allow anybody to have a firearm within 1,000 feet of a congressman. Now think about what he's saying. Okay, you're not going to allow any person to have a gun within 1,000 feet of a congressman. Well, if you think back to the incidents that have occurred in schools over the last 20 years, there are plenty of federal and state laws that restrict guns from school zones, yet criminals, which is who we're talking about here, they don't pay attention to the law. So obviously, the restrictions, the undue restrictions on Second Amendment rights, are going to affect the law-abiding citizens who have no evil intention, as opposed to having any impact on the criminal element. Think about the same circumstances. Let's assume there was already a law in place that said nobody can have a firearm within 1,000 feet of the congressman at this open-air meeting, community gathering, whatever the case was. The bad guys aren't going to pay attention to that, and therefore it's not going to have any impact. And he was standing right beside Mayor Bloomberg, the mayor of New York, who is the head of the Mayors Against Illegal Guns, and his coalition that basically puts the blame on the guns instead of putting individual personal responsibility on people. He tends to put it on the thing, the gun, and it's obviously misguided. And the reality is that that's not what's happening. It's not the guns. It's people doing bad things. It's people doing bad things, and we have to focus on that.
I think that Representative Peter King of New York probably wanted to do the right thing. He actually has been kind of on our side and on the side of gun owners, on the side of liberty. He is one of the rare Republicans from New York. But I think there was just a sense of, we've got to do something, and at least if we can do this, it would help. What he fails to recognize, and I'm certain that he will, especially since the National Rifle Association is chartered in the state of New York, my guess is he'll probably hear some different explanations for why that's not such a good idea. Because it doesn't matter what law that you pass, somebody who is dedicated to doing harm is not going to pay attention to the law. The fact that there's Congress has passed a law saying, oh, you can't have a gun within 1,000 feet of anybody from Congress, isn't going to stop someone who is going to get within 4 feet and pull a trigger. It's not going to happen. Those laws don't deter those people. All they do is make it more difficult for the law-abiding citizen to do their normal things. And yeah. And it's the wrong answer. I'm sure it won't go anywhere, because we have a very substantial pro-gun majority, actually including members of both parties, in both the House and the Senate. It's just simply not going to happen. But these are the kinds of things that, unfortunately, the media doesn't challenge the premise. And that's what's wrong with that particular proposal. The premise is, we can pass a law that's going to make this better. And that's simply false. If you accept the premise, then you can go down seriously wrong paths of illogic, because it's the foundation upon which the discussion is begun is wrong.
Well, and I know that already there are people out there who have an opinion about that. And again, I want to encourage you to call in today, and let's get you on the air to voice your opinion. Either way, again, this is one of the reasons we started this show, was to create hearty dialogue, meaningful dialogue, to discuss issues that have this kind of impact on our society. I want to also mention that here's what's real interesting. When we talk about Second Amendment rights, situations like this result in people, you know, knee-jerk reaction coming out of the coming from all angles, wanting to further restrict the Second Amendment. Well, here's what I want to offer to you. I haven't heard a single individual yet who said that, hey, it's pretty unequivocal. It's very clear that this individual committed this offense. And how about if we all of a sudden start treading on his Fourth Amendment rights to unreasonable search and seizure, and we just go ahead and start searching his computer, his cell phone, any residence he lived in without warrants, without probable cause, or his Fifth Amendment rights to self-incrimination, and the heck with the trial by jury, because we know he's guilty, so why should we go ahead and let him have due process as is guaranteed?
There's nothing that a lawyer can do for him anyway, because they've got it on video, so why bother with the Sixth Amendment?
Yeah, and the Sixth Amendment doesn't need counsel. And then I think the people of the state of Arizona would have an opinion about the Eighth Amendment, cruel and unusual punishment. But here again, obviously I'm being sarcastic and facetious about that. But the point is, the people who argue against the Second Amendment are equally have equally ridiculous arguments. There is no substance to what they're saying. The bottom line is those are inalienable rights that our founding fathers thought were so critical to our existence that they felt that those cannot be infringed. And Marx says it so eloquently. He says the Second Amendment, the aspects of the right to keep and bear arms, shall not be infringed. It doesn't say that under certain circumstances we will and certain circumstances we won't. The bottom line is it won't be infringed.
Now, you may not agree with us, and that's fine. We really want you to call in. In fact, there's a possibility that we've got somebody who already has called in. Let's go to Wendell, who's called in from Fairborn. Wendell, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
What is it that you'd like to share on this?
Well, I'd like to share that your talk show host is, or your talk show is talking about everything, news that Congress and the mass media want to talk about, but you don't want to talk about news that actually is not in the general media.
Okay, we got about a minute before we need to take a break, so go to
it. For instance, did you know that 200 Saudi Arabians will be getting a free made-in-USA drug called natalizumab to see if it helps them walk?
Okay.
Did you know that? It's a national clinical trial, number...
All right, but I'm having difficulty seeing where that connection comes to.
This is a drug being given to people with serious neurological disorders.
Okay.
And in contrast to that, we've been fighting for over 7 years in Iraq and Afghanistan. Am I right?
Yes, you are.
The only clinical trial that the Department of Defense is sponsoring is for refined fish oil.
Well, what are you suggesting?
Did you know that? I mean, that's news. It's on a government website.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what.
You can go to these things. You can go to clinicaltrials.gov.
Well, we're going to have to go to a break right now. And when we come back, we'll get back on that very issue. You're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Rachel Parsons, spokesperson for the National Rifle Association, and you're on Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
I want to welcome our listeners back to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip, brought to you by Sim Trainer. Just before the break, I just want to remind our listeners that when you call in, we want to talk about some of the issues relevant to our show. I'm sure the gentleman had some concerns about some maybe health-related issues or some studies in the health field that would probably have been best served on other shows on the TalkNet, but we're going to try to focus on firearms-related issues. And I want to get back to what I was talking about before the break when we were discussing the incident that occurred in Arizona last week, and I just want to add a couple more details. One of the two gentlemen that subdued this individual actually was a concealed carry holder who was carrying at the time. And in his interview, he said that he was kind of stuck between what his response would be, but because of his prior background and his confidence, his ability, he decided since the gun had run dry, since the bad guy's gun had run dry and there was a window of opportunity, he just decided that he was going to physically subdue the attacker, which was certainly for the circumstances based on what he was facing at that particular time, which is the standard that we generally encourage people to go under, his own ability, the window of opportunity, it was a good option. Could he have drawn his gun and shot the individual? Absolutely.
Well, at that time, the gun had already been taken by another person. One of the other people had subdued him. So, I mean,
if he would have gotten, if he'd actually been there and he saw this going on, could he have subdued the individual by shooting him
Absolutely.
Instead of taking him to the ground? Absolutely. So the use of deadly force to stop people from using deadly force on other people is certainly justified and capable. But he made that decision. That's a personal decision, and it was a right decision, and he is an American hero. The other issue that I want to bring up that's come up not only in this particular matter but also in the Deputy Hopper investigation is this whole concept of the mental health field, some of the shortcomings or some of the issues that need to be addressed there as far as conducting follow-up visits on people who are released from mental facilities then regularly doing follow-ups to make sure that they're doing what they're supposed to be doing, taking care of their medications. And I know the statistic in Ohio was that with the closing of the Dayton State Hospital, there are between, according to the newspaper accounts, between 3,000 and 4,000 people who were put in what they call independent living situations that are in fact monitored. But you can imagine with budgetary cuts being the way they are and finances being the way they are around the state, that's going to be a difficult proposition. So this is a multifaceted problem that needs to be attacked from a variety of different angles. And there's no one approach. It's just that we have to look at it from a number of different angles. And the big thing is, I just want to emphasize again, this incident in Arizona was it just substantiates our claim that it's only going to be through private individuals acting in spontaneous, heroic manners, ways that we're going to be able to minimize the hurt in these kind of incidents, which are going to continue to happen. That's not going to go away. I know for the last 20 or 30 years, you can just do a search of spontaneous incidents of gunfire or active shooter situations in this country, and there have been numerous. You look at the Virginia Tech shooting, the Columbine incident, Spokane, Washington, Paducah, Kentucky. There have been incident after incident after incident. Utah Mall, Minnesota or Wisconsin Mall. There have been plenty of those that happened, and they're going to continue to happen, and we have to protect ourselves. We just simply have to protect ourselves.
Let's go out quickly out to the phone and talk to Jeff in Moraine, who's been hanging on for quite a while. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Hi there.
Hi. What was your question?
I actually had a couple of different questions. I guess we can stay on topic here concerning the incidents in Arizona. What rights does a concealed carry holder have in an active shooter situation in an establishment that has, within the parking lot or what have you, a no gun sign?
When you say rights, I mean they have the basic, you know, you're talking about just for Ohio, I assume, because that's, you know, obviously the focus of where we are and what the laws that we know best.
Right. Let's say, for instance, you know, with this incident in Arizona, they had a no gun sign there, and as me as a holder saw that unfolding, and I wanted to go and protect
okay.
other people's lives.
Mark, let's restrict it to Ohio.
Yeah,
we're
going to have to talk. Assuming that happened in Ohio, what you would have, I mean, you would be certainly be able to, if somebody is under a risk of deadly threat, and you know as much as that person does about the threat, and in that situation where somebody's being shot, clearly that, you know, when you have an active shooter situation, you as a citizen have the, I mean, it's not illegal for you to intervene and do what is necessary to stop the threat. You can defend another as long as you have enough information to know that. We need to take a break at the bottom of the hour, and we'll come back to this after the hour. If you can hang on with us, we'll get back to you. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. We'll be headed over to the news center with Charles Van Sand in just a few seconds. Give us a call at 457-1290 if you'd like to be on the show. You're listening to AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
God bless America. This is your blood brother, Ted Nugent, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome our listeners back to this broadcast of Shooting from the Hip. This is Jeff Pedro and with Mark Avery. We're from Sim Trainer. And just before the break, the caller had a question about what would happen, and we kind of directed it to a situation, similar situation occurring here in Ohio, where there was a shooting in a open-air environment, particularly a parking lot. And Mark, why don't you just kind of take them through that discussion?
Yeah, if there were signs up on the edge of the parking lot, and some of the stores have those. A lot of times those are there not because the store manager wants them there, but because their insurance company says, if you don't have these signs up, then we're not going to cover you. In the last change to the law that went into effect in September of 2008, the Ohio legislature changed the rules so that if you have a parking lot or an open-air area like that, that has a sign that says no firearms permitted, the only effect that can have is it's no longer a criminal offense. It's no longer criminal trespassing. Now it's just civil trespass. So if there was going to be any action, it would be on the part of the store owner to file a lawsuit saying, you know, I'm going to sue you for trespassing on our property because we don't want you there with a gun. And since you had a gun, we don't want you there. And frankly, that's just simply not going to happen. Especially if in a situation where, like the one in Arizona, where it's people who were armed, although they did not choose to use the firearm as part of the defense, they were armed. At least one of the people we know was armed and went in to take action. after the fact, if that person had then been found to be behind beyond that sign, I doubt seriously there would be any action. Certainly, the folks at the store would not file suit. It's just one of those things. There was one other aspect. The question is Senate Bill 239 and the restaurant carry in an establishment that serves alcohol. That bill died with the end of the last session of the Ohio House. There was never a voting session brought up once that discharge petition had been voted on. So there was no way for the Ohio House to vote on that, on the Senate bill that had already passed the Senate. So they are now going to start over. That has already been put together. They're already in the process of writing the new bills and the aspects of that bill, Senate Bill 249, possibly some aspects of other things that were pending. And we'll just have to see what happens when the Ohio House starts, the House and Senate really start their big work. Let's go out and talk to Tim in Yellow Springs, who has a comment about the Tucson shooting. And welcome to the show, Tim.
Thanks. Yeah, I heard on Fox TV last week the gentleman who had the concealed carry gun on his person, he got to the middle of the scene, and he said when he got there, he hadn't drawn his pistol, fortunately,
that's correct.
Everyone. And instead of deciding to do what he might have done, he went down and helped hold down the shooter.
Well, as it happens, the shooter no longer had the gun.
Had his thought process been a little different, the person holding the gun when he got there was the person who had taken the gun away from the shooter.
Yeah, that's correct.
And he could have drawn his pistol and shot, but yeah.
Yeah, but I mean, if he had, it would have been a tragedy. That would have been a terrible thing, and he recognized that, and he was aware of what was going on. I think that's a key point for folks who carry a firearm for personal defense. It ain't about shooting. You need to be thinking and paying attention to what's going on and not just focusing in on what little information you got. Situational awareness is absolutely essential, and that young man, he's only 24. He did a great job in that regard.
Right. Well, as they taught us in concealed carry class, when you come upon a scene, what's actually going on may not be exactly what you think is happening, so it might be best to just use that pistol to defend yourself and those people immediately with you, such as your family, and not try to be a cop.
Well, again, I just want to clarify that, because I think that it's a good comment, but I want to say that we hear that often in our classes. I want people to understand that when you say to defend yourself and your family, My stance on this is that if you're willing to defend yourself and your family, you should be willing to defend any innocent citizen in public. And the key thing there is making sure you know the circumstances you're getting into. It's not whether or not you're going to choose to defend your daughter, your brother, your sister, your uncle, your friend versus a stranger. It's whether or not you know the circumstances. Because let me just tell you that individual who chose not to draw his gun mentioned that one of the other concerns he had is that when law enforcement ultimately arrived on the scene, that he might be mistaken as the or one of the gunmen, which is all the things that should be going through a person's head. But I don't want that to preclude the understanding that when people choose to carry a gun for personal safety and self-defense, a lot of these issues are really non-issues. One other issue is the proximity of other people, bystanders, and he didn't want to take a shot because he was worried that he might hit other people. Remember, if an active shooter is shooting and you have a chance to take a shot, yeah, there's always that possibility. But if you take the responsibility of carrying a gun and potentially using it to defend your life seriously, you'll get the practice and you'll be confident enough in your ability to eliminate that threat, and you won't refrain from action and let the killer continue on his killing spree. Because remember, I don't know the time parameters there. I don't know what the specific circumstances, and there were probably law enforcement in the general vicinity who were certainly coming to the area, but it was only going to be spontaneous acts of heroic people that were going to minimize the hurt in this particular case, because had he been able to reload that gun the second time, there would have been much more death. That's a fact. That's what we know. So
We agree.
Yeah, absolutely. Tim, thanks very much for calling the show. One of the issues that has come up and has been brought up by our folks over on the other side of the fence is the size of the magazine that he had. I mean, he had a 33-round magazine. It was reported as he had 31 rounds in it. Whatever the number is, it's not relevant. The point is that they're trying to now say, well, that means we should ban those extra-large capacity magazines. And remember back when in the good old days when we had the Clinton gun ban in effect and you could only get a magazine with up to 10 rounds? See, that would have solved this problem. Here's the argument I would make against that. First, one of the reasons he could not reload was because somebody else grabbed that magazine when he dropped it. I suspect that part of the reason he dropped that magazine is because a 30-round magazine filled with 9mm ammo is heavy and awkward. In fact, it weighs more than the gun he was shooting. So the very fact that that was the size of magazine that he was using probably kept him from being able to reload it effectively. And we've seen this at the range. We've got some folks that have those large magazines, and frankly, they don't shoot as much with a large magazine as they do. They don't shoot as well with a large magazine as they do with a normal standard round, 10, 15, whatever round magazine. And that was a 19 as a Glock 19 has a 15-round magazine as its normal size.
Absolutely. There's a lot of those issues. And you know, take a trained shooter like Mark or myself with 3 10-round magazines, we can probably do get off as many, if not more, shots than a person inexperienced with a 31-round magazine. There's a lot of misconceptions about that. And then there's also probably the misconception about the type of gun he had, that he just had to pull the trigger one time and it would shoot all 31 of those rounds, which was not the case as far as we know. And, you know, there's just a whole lot of issues out there. And the big thing is just to understand the impact of what actually happened, and look at all the facts, which all the facts aren't in, but they're reasonably accurate right now because there have been news conferences with law enforcement who reported the facts consistent with their preliminary investigation. Now, the investigation will be ongoing, and there may be additional facts that come up later on, but the fact is we know pretty much what happened there, and we're right on point. This whole issue also about if you look at the violence rates in this country, again, I want to refer you to the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, and if you have access to the computer, you just Uniform Crime Reports or FBI Uniform Crime Reports.
Well, you can also go to our website at sim-trainer.com/radio, and we've referenced that several times during the last couple of years.
Mark mentioned the restrictions during the Clinton gun ban years, which probably were from 1996 to 2005, 1994 to 2005, somewhere in there. Look at the homicide rates relative to firearms for that 10-year period, and you compare it to any other 10-year period, you're going to find it was probably as high, if not higher, than, say, the last 10 years. And it had virtually no impact. That's the fact. And you can base that on the official data, which is the FBI Uniform Crime Reports, which is the compilation of the required data reporting for local law enforcement agencies around the country for such incidents.
Well, the flip side of that will be to look at Washington, D.C. in the 2 years since the Heller decision. It'll be interesting to see what those statistics look like. Yeah. We don't have final statistics yet. We do have some from 2009. That's pretty solid, but I haven't studied those. What I understand to be the case was that there was a significant drop, but I haven't looked at the numbers myself, so I'm not going to say what other people have reported about that. We'll do that one of these days here, yeah. Because that's a really good test case. That was the epitome of what the anti-gun crowd wants to have happen, was a complete ban on handguns and severe restrictions on what you could even do in your own home, to the point where you couldn't even have an assembled shotgun or rifle for personal defense in your home and be in compliance with the law. And that was the anti-gunners' desired situation. And now we have 30 years of that, or 31 years of that. And then we had now a full year of statistics following the decision in 2008. They stonewalled for some time on how long it was going to take for, you know, to get licenses and for people to get guns and so forth. So that took a while. It'll be interesting to see what those statistics look like.
Yeah. And just before we came on the air, Greg Sucker mentioned that he was playing cards with a group of his friends, and one of the individuals who just happened to be a retired police chief, they apparently were into a discussion. He was mentioning that he's totally in opposition to anybody but law enforcement officers carrying firearms. And if you happen to watch the news last week, Sheriff Dupnick, who's the sheriff of Pima County, where Tucson is, he also spoke out and saying that he's not at all in favor of private citizens carrying firearms. And I'm going to make the assumption that he's of the belief that law enforcement should handle such circumstances. And I'm going to tell you, as a 25-year law enforcement veteran, I couldn't say that there's nothing farther from the truth. The simple fact is we need to have a citizenry that's armed, willing, ready, and capable to deal with such situations and take that responsibility serious, not only from the standpoint of the Second Amendment and our Second Amendment right, but just from a practical standpoint about the way the world is. Spontaneous acts of extreme violence occur just that, spontaneously, and we need people ready, willing, and capable to respond. And it's upsetting and disappointing when people, especially in those positions, as happened in the early stages of the concealed carry debate in the state of Ohio, when they speak out against citizens having guns. Their arguments simply don't play out. They have no legitimacy.
We're going to take our last break for the hour, and when we come back, we'll talk to Tommy and Jeff, and we'll take your calls at 457-1290. You give us a call, and we'll get you up on the board and try to get as many calls in as we can for the end of the hour. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Hi, this is Cam Edwards from NRANews.com, and you're listening to Shooting from the Hip on AM 1290 and 95.7 FM, News Talk Radio, WHIO.
Welcome back to the show. This is Mark Avery in here with Jeff Pedro. Let's go right back out to the phones and go talk to Jeff and Moraine. Jeff, welcome back to the show.
I was interested in the legal ramifications of citizens' arrest. I know Mr. Pedro is a law enforcement official in Kettering, and, you know, if an incident happens, what can and can't we do as a citizen to subdue a suspect until law enforcement arrives?
That's different from citizen's arrest, but it's, go ahead, Jeff.
Now, specific, give me a specific example.
Let's say I'm at Speedway and I see an individual holding up the cash till, and as a concealed carry person, I draw my gun, tell the individual to get down on the ground, don't move, and let's say I cuff them, and I'm waiting for law enforcement to arrive. How does that play out?
I would say based on the facts you give, as you describe them there, you'd be totally legitimate in doing so. Again, it's going to come down to your individual ability, your perception of your ability, your perception of the situation, whether or not you could control it. There are a lot of circumstances that can evolve there. You know, you gotta, people say, well, I'm going to wait and see what he does. Well, if you wait and see what he does and he shoots one of the patrons or he shoots one of the clerks, then your waiting kind of causes you a life of misery of having to deal with that. So in the example you gave, based on the circumstances and assuming you feel you're competent and capable of handling that situation, that would be totally warranted. And in other situations, as long as your actions are reasonable, that's what the court's going to look at. Specifically in the element of a felony, any person can make an arrest for a felony in the state of Ohio. And in misdemeanor cases, it's going to basically depend on a case-by-case basis based on the circumstances. But clearly in this case, you're talking about a felony, you've got statutory law backing you, and you got practicality and reasonableness on your side.
I would say one other thing, and that is with respect to handcuffs, if you have not been trained to handcuff a non-voluntary prisoner, I wouldn't do that, because that's a situation that requires significant training, and you need to really know what you're doing, or you could get in more trouble than you would have otherwise. So
it's a tactical issue where you would have to do something with your firearm while you're moving into handcuff, and that would jeopardize yourself. It would be best just to keep him at bay until the police get on the scene, and then you decide how you're going to handle that.
Okay, thanks for calling. Let's go out to Tommy in Dayton. Tommy, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I just would like to thank you all, because basically I took your first shot training, and I basically grew up around guns and stuff like that. My wife wanted to do something that I like doing, so she set it up for both of us to go and stuff like that, and she turned around there and learned a lot of stuff, and it's now more into guns and gun safety, and later on this year we are planning on getting our concealed weapons training together.
Well, that's outstanding. That's great news. And frankly, that's kind of nice to be able to end the show on such an up note, because it's been a little heavy in here today. Tom, thanks very much for calling the show, and I'm glad you and your wife enjoyed the First Shots class. Anybody else interested in First Shots? We're going to have we've still only got a few slots left. I think maybe there's three or four
for February.
The 5th of February. And we'll have to probably put another class together. But if you're interested in that, you can call the range at 293-3914. If you have interest in, maybe you're already a shooter and you'd like to get more advanced training, move up into personal defense caliber, we have a concealed carry class going this weekend, and we'll have another one in the middle of February, Monday through Thursday evenings. and we'll be able to get you in on that. We actually, next weekend, we have a basic handgun class. So if you're interested in learning more, or maybe you're in the process of selecting a firearm for personal defense, the basic handgun class is a great way to do that. That gives you an opportunity to shoot pretty much everything we have in the safe, and we will help you fit a gun to you, in addition to learning the fundamentals and learning how to place an accurate shot. So we'd love to have you come do that. Again, the number at the range is 293-3914. We'd love to have you participate. This is Mark Avery and Jeff Pedro for Shooting from the Hip. You're listening to AM 1290 and now 95.7 FM News Talk Radio, WHIO.